Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
All right, hello, and welcome to yet another episode of Hoth Takes. I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Eric Geller.
And today we are continuing our discussion of the original trilogy, or OT, as us cool fans on the internet call it, with the third and final movie in the OT, Return of the Jedi, which is much maligned by some fans for the inclusion of Ewoks and other decisions. But I personally am a Return of the Jedi apologist. I think it's a super fun movie. I enjoy it more than A New Hope, which is blasphemy, I am aware, but such is life. And today we're kind of going to be continuing our discussion of pretending that we were audience members in the 70s and 80s watching these movies. So first we were audience members in 77, then it was 1980 for Empire Strikes Back, and now we are well into the first term of the Reagan administration for 1983, Return of the Jedi. So pretending here that we have only seen the A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back beforehand, and now Return of the Jedi. We've never seen any prequels. We've never read any expanded universe, RIP expanded universe, or Disney canon books. We've never seen the Clone Wars TV show. We are just in 1983 watching this for the first time. So with those caveats, Eric, what do you think of Return of the Jedi as a conclusion to a trilogy? Do you think it does an effective job, what it's supposed to do in kind of wrapping up this story that started with A New Hope?
I do. You know, as I was thinking about the end of this movie, one of the things that I think it's important to note is you get closure with Vader and, you know, Palpatine dies, the second Death Star is destroyed. But it leaves open the door for your imagination to continue telling the story because, you know, we've seen enough of the Imperial fleet to know that this is not just game over. Even without the expanded universe, you can intuit that there are going to be holdouts, people who are not going to surrender. I mean, this happens in war. And so you can imagine that this is not the end of the story for these people. I think that's actually, you could compare it to The Rise of Skywalker in that sense, where, you know, there's this major victory, but it's not as if every ship is destroyed. It does give you nice, clean resolutions for a lot of the tensions with our heroes, right? Luke, his relationship with Vader reaches a nice, satisfying point. Han and Leia's relationship is, you know, in a sense, consummated, right? They acknowledge that they are, you know, have feelings for each other, and they kiss, and that is sort of a formal kind of quote unquote relationship at that point. Obviously, you know, we know that things go wrong after that, but 1983, that looks like it's the happily ever after type of connection for the two of them. And then obviously on the bigger scale, the political dynamic shifts somewhat. And again, even without, you know, Truce at Bakura and all those, you know, the Thrawn trilogy and all the books that happen after Return of the Jedi, you know, you can tell that if you wanted to tell more stories here, you'd be able to. So it does, it handles that really nicely. I think it does wrap things up, but it's not like this is a true happily ever after in the literal, you know, textbook fantasy story kind of way. There is an open door here for some of this conflict to continue.
Yeah, I would agree here. I think that it's a very satisfying conclusion, while, like you said, still leaving things open. I mean, we end with an Ewok dance party, but we know that there are still things that need to be resolved. And I also thought, while watching it again, because it's been several years since I've seen Return of the Jedi, and actually since I've seen all three of the trilogy, original trilogy movies in a row. And I really kind of appreciated for the first time, maybe, how Return of the Jedi really is thematically very similar to A New Hope. I mean, you are starting off with another Death Star. You're starting off in Tatooine, where the story started for Luke, and with all of these cool, fun monsters. And like, I'm kind of jumping around in my notes here, but like A New Hope, Return of the Jedi has more of a clear morality than Empire Strikes Back. We talked a lot in the last episode about the sort of gray morality of Empire compared to kind of the clear-cut black and white, good and evil, light side and dark side of A New Hope. And Return of the Jedi kind of does a return to that. I mean, there's still some gray in terms of Luke's battle internally over light side and dark side and external battle with his father. But I want to ask, are we satisfied with the kind of return to that clear morality of this movie? So do we think it's realistic how Luke is able to resist the dark side despite some setbacks, and how Vader is redeemed and essentially becomes Anakin Skywalker again? How do we feel about that after coming from the sort of grayness of Empire? Is it satisfying, or is it a little too neat?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, Star Wars, you know, has always been a fantasy story, and so to expect extreme nuance, especially in the core Skywalker, you know, saga, and especially in a concluding story, has always been, you know, it's always been folly to expect things to get really, really super nuanced. That being said, I do have, you know, times where I watch this movie and I think that, yeah, Vader did not deserve that ending. I mean, he, you know, this is where you sort of get into the tension between really, you know, immersing yourself in the universe and thinking about everything, not just that you actually saw happen, but also that he must have done off screen. The tension between that analytical framework and the sort of the analytical framework that I think George Lucas was applying, you know, that the idea that this is a kid's movie that is supposed to teach you about good and evil and how, you know, it's never too late to do the right thing. I mean, that is the framework that I think he applied as he made the movie. He certainly talked about what he was trying to do with this movie. And so there is a tension there. Now, personally, I think you can still tell a story that teaches the right lessons without taking the easy way out on somebody like Darth Vader. I think when you get to this last part of the movie, it's almost like, you know, Lucas knew that he wanted Luke to have closure with Vader and with Anakin, and that the only way to do that really was to basically give Luke the victory that he was seeking, which is, I know there's good in him, I know I can redeem him, and that had to happen in order for Luke to reach his sort of that point in his hero's journey. You know, you could call that the end of his hero's journey, and everything after that is sort of the postscript. But of course, to do that, you've got to allow Anakin Skywalker to emerge, and that creates a lot of tension, especially for people who, again, like I said, have been thinking a lot about, you know, the things that Darth Vader did in his life. So it's a complicated question. I don't know that I have a yes or no on, like, do I think that it was appropriate? I will say the more I think about it, the more I lean toward it is a little bit too much of a cop-out. And listen, I mean, part of that goes to maybe when the Force is at work, there are just some kind of spiritual cleansings that can happen in a way that in the real world, where we don't have this mystical power at work, can be hard for us to understand. I mean, I don't even know necessarily if that explanation makes sense, but I guess what I'm saying is in this fantasy world, maybe the rules of what the cosmic force thinks is redeemable and what it doesn't are different than what we would expect if we tried to apply that moral framework to our own real world.
I think that's getting a bit, like, space force-y, explanation-y. Which is not a great way to rebut your argument, but it's a bit much for me. I think that it's just ROTJ is more of a kid's movie than Empire is. It's more similar to A New Hope in that way. And this is, like you said, I think you made a really good point about how it's basically a fantasy story that's just talking about good and evil, and this is an easy way to do that, and to also teach about redemption, which is an important story, important lesson. And I personally think it's a bit too easy to just kind of let Vader off the hook and to give Luke that kind of closure, because in real life there isn't that kind of closure often, and it's messier, and redemption is harder and requires more work than just one good act at the end of your life and then you die. But at the same time, you know, this is Star Wars. It's a fantasy story. It's not meant to have that level of complexity necessarily in the core movies. Like, that's something that can be explored more in other properties. And I think in the original Expanded Universe books, there was a good kind of dealing with the moral complexity and the legacy of Vader and all that jazz. But of course, none of that is canon anymore. But I think ultimately I am satisfied with the ending of Return of the Jedi in that respect, also partially because I am an Anakin fan, which is super embarrassing, because he's the worst and super annoying. But now going back from pretending I'm an audience member in 1983 to just being my real actual self who has seen every property, you know, I think it's a nice conclusion for Anakin's story. And when you think about all six movies in terms of being Anakin's story, it's a nice little bow to his journey. Which brings me to my next point, which is that Return of the Jedi really establishes the trilogy, the OT, as a family story in a way that A New Hope and Empire aren't to the same extent. I mean, in A New Hope, as far as the audience is concerned, none of these people are related. They're all just strangers who happen to be going on this cool journey together. And then Empire establishes Vader as Luke's father, so that brings the familial element into it and hints at Leia being Luke's sister, but it's just a hint. But Return of the Jedi really solidifies it as a family story, because we have Luke confronting and redeeming his father, Leia being Luke's sister, and their relationship being developed in that way. So looking at this, looking at the first two movies in the trilogy from the perspective of, okay, now we've seen Return of the Jedi, how does our understanding of this as a family story kind of change our perspective on the first two movies in the trilogy?
Well, part of it goes to something I was going to say about Anakin, and this being the Anakin story, which is, you know, his failure in the prequel trilogy is ignoring the Jedi warnings about attachments and how they can lead you astray. And yet his redemption in this movie comes about because of his attachments. He only saves Luke because of who Luke is to him. If Luke were some random person who was in that same situation, I don't think he would have betrayed the Emperor. It's all right about him taking stock in that moment and saying, is this who I want to be? Is this where I want to be? Can I break out of this prison? And getting the inspiration from his son to actually break out of the prison, to believe that he can do it. And the actual motivation to try to do it comes from the fact that this is his son. So there's a nice little symmetry there in that he actually ultimately prevails by doing the thing that got him in trouble, in one sense. I will connect that to your question by saying, ultimately, this is a story about what do family attachments do to us, right? I mean, Padme was not a relative of Anakin's, but certainly this started with Shmi. That is where we saw that first hint of darkness from Anakin. And so as we go through the first six movies, what we see is different members of this family are handling their attachments differently. When this all gets wrapped up in Return of the Jedi, and Luke does save his father through their familial connection, what we see sort of retroactively across the three movies is Luke succeeding where Anakin failed in terms of managing his attachments. And in Empire, there is that note of warning, which is, you know, from Obi-Wan and Yoda saying, be careful, the Emperor wants your power and he will do whatever it takes to get it. And again, Leia and Han, well, as far as Luke knows at that moment, Leia and Han are not related to him. However, it's thematically linked with this idea of family attachments, because he's going in on this impulsive mission to save people that are close to him. And again, you have the Anakin Padme connection there, where they're not related, but they have that close connection. And yet Luke is able to resist the dark side in both Empire, when Vader tempts him, and Jedi, when the Emperor says, you know, kill your father and join me. You know, he's able to overcome those temptations by managing his desires to protect people close to him in a way that Anakin just couldn't do it. And so that's what I think you get with this movie. It's sort of the capstone of this exploration of what does it mean to be tempted and to have allegiances to people close to you, and how do you manage that, and how do you act on that in a responsible way? And I think Jedi sort of puts the bow on that and makes it clear that that's what this is about all along.
I agree with you like 95% on all of that, and about Star Wars being really about a family story and about attachments. My one point of disagreement with you is that I think actually in Empire, Luke fails, and he isn't drawn into the dark side, but that's more because of circumstance, I think, than anything else, because it is his attachment to Leia and Han, where because he is unwilling to let go of them and to trust them to handle things on their own, even though they might be in danger. So because he has this vision of them in danger, he decides to abandon his training despite the warnings of both Yoda and Obi-Wan, and despite both of them telling him attachments are bad and this will get you drawn into the dark side. He ignores their warnings. He's unwilling to let go of his friendships. And so he goes to Cloud City and ultimately gets his hand cut off and is emotionally devastated. And I think the fact that he's not drawn into the dark side at that point is less to do with him actively resisting the dark side and more with him resisting his father. It's more personal than that, and him wanting to escape from the truth of who he is, who his father is. And so he's at the point where he's literally like, well, I would just rather fall down several stories than deal with this right now. Which is relatable. I get it. I too would rather fall down several stories than deal with difficult family problems. But I think that it's in Return of the Jedi where he has learned to let go of his attachments, but it's a struggle for him because he sees the rebel fleet failing and is getting really angry. He does almost kill Vader. It's only when he cuts off Vader's hand that he's like, whoa, we both have mechanical hands. Wow. It's connection of some kind. And that's when he realizes that he is able to let go of his anger. But I think that it's not easy for Luke to get to that point. And first, there is some failure there, even in Return of the Jedi, when he's more secure and self-assured, that there's still, at the ending, that little sense of, well, will he go to the dark side? I mean, of course, you know he won't. But I do think that Return of the Jedi does that well, of showing Luke's journey in that way.
Yeah, I mean, definitely he's not perfect in Empire. He has that Skywalker family impulsiveness, that need to control. Again, it's ironic that Yoda says, you know, you need to learn control, because really he feels that he needs to have control over the fate of his friends, just like Anakin needed to control Padme's health and safety. It's motivated by a good impulse to help others, but the inability to accept that some things are not yours to control is unhealthy, even if it comes from a good place. And so, yes, he does rush off to confront Vader, so he isn't able to resist that temptation. However, I would say it's not like he's, you know, choosing to fall down a flight of stairs. I mean, he and Vader, I think, both in that moment believe that he's likely to die from that fall. Certainly anybody watching that movie, not knowing that, if you didn't know that that guy was the star of the movie, you'd probably imagine that he's about to die. I mean, I think we got to give him a little more credit there for that choice that he makes, and I don't think it's just that he's in shock and that he doesn't want to deal with this revelation. I think it's honestly that he feels the pull of family, you know, let's defeat the ultimate bad guy together. We have this pre-existing connection. We can build off of that. And he's choosing to say no and taking a very brave stance in doing so. You know, as far as Return of the Jedi is concerned, I don't think that his first moment of sort of maturity and resisting the urge to fight comes when he sees, you know, that he and Vader have this same kind of more machine now than man, you know, thing developing. He does earlier on say, you know, I won't fight you. And if Vader says, if you won't fight, you'll die. And that's kind of where their lightsaber battle begins. And he approaches that moment in a very Zen way, not wanting to fight, rising above those temptations. It is only when Vader plays on, you know, the relationship with Leia that he actually starts to go bonkers, if you want to use the technical term for it. And that is ultimately when that's the part of the fight that culminates with him almost killing Vader. So again, there's evidence here for both, you know, the perspective that Luke is able to succeed where Anakin failed, and the opposite, right? Because ultimately, when he charges after Vader, when Vader mentions Leia, that is the same kind of failure that led Anakin down the dark path. So it's not as if he's perfect at any point in Return of the Jedi. I just don't know that I would say that he is failing as badly as Anakin was right up until that moment with where he cuts off his hand. I would give him a little bit more credit for having more development and maturity prior to that moment.
That's fair. Yeah. I would agree with that, and agree with your position about Luke being pretty zen until Vader mentions Leia, and then you're right, he goes bonkers. He is, I think, something that's so striking about Return of the Jedi, especially coming right after Empire Strikes Back, is that from the very beginning of the movie, Luke is just so much more mature. He's a lot more confident in himself and his capabilities in the Force, and he's really come to terms with his past in a way that's very responsible. And that kind of brings me to my next discussion point, which is about our trio and the three key characters in this movie, Luke, Han, and Leia, and whether this is a satisfying conclusion for them as individual characters. And I think with Luke, without question, he has such a great arc over the three movies, and in this movie in particular, just starting from Jabba's palace with him being this confident Jedi Knight to him going to Yoda's little hut on Dagobah and being able to acknowledge his mistakes and give his apologies for leaving his training, to his conversation with Obi-Wan, to the final confrontation with Vader. Like, he's really, over the past three movies, grown up, and you see that in this movie particularly. And he gets this really beautiful ending where he's able to find closure with his father and defeat the Empire and move on to bigger and better things. But I think that compared to Luke's arc, for me personally, Leia and Han's arcs are much less satisfying. But before I go into my reasons for that, I wanted to ask you first about what do you think about the three characters and how this movie treats them?
Well, I will say that even though we don't really see how Luke gets to this point, the amount of time that passes, I think, makes it believable. I agree with you saying that he, I think he does have the clearest, most logically developed arc of the main characters in terms of, you know, we can tell from the, you know, point in A New Hope where he says, I want to become a Jedi like my father before me. It's like, well, okay, you probably are not going to have the character say that if you don't want them to succeed at that goal. I mean, that is the hero's journey, and it's not very satisfying to tell a story where the hero never ends up completing the journey, especially not back then. That was what was clearly being planned. How he gets there is another question. But yeah, I think it was always obvious that he was going to become, to some degree, a master of the Force. And so that's straightforward, you know, the magic boy learns how to use his magic, right? I think maybe we should talk a little bit about how I think, you know, Han and Leia get less well-rounded stories here. And part of that is just because this is Luke's trilogy. We all know that. But, you know, they certainly don't, you know, there's a way to set up this trilogy as Luke Skywalker and then supporting characters Leia and Han. To their credit, I think they make it pretty clear in, you know, the marketing materials and the promotional photography and all that, that this is really a trio story to some degree. Even if Luke and the Force stuff is at the center of the main story, you would expect better from the way that Leia and Han get, you know, have their stories developed. You would expect them to have more fully fledged stories, even if they are to some degree the B story to Luke's A story. And I know that you have some pretty strong feelings about, you know, the role that Leia has in this movie.
I do indeed. I mean, we all know of my love for Leia, but that really is, my love for Leia comes despite the storylines that she is given in the original trilogy. And she has more to do in Return of the Jedi than she has in the other two films. And I appreciate that. But it's still pretty sexist, because even when she has things to do, they're kind of overshadowed by her status as the female character. So, for example, in Jabba's palace, she goes and she saves Han, and it's a very badass little play that she does where she dresses up and covers her face and pretends to be an alien, and does the little trick with the bomb saying she'll blow up the palace. And then in the dead of night, she goes to unfreeze Han, and Jabba's onto her. And so she is pretty much set up to fail. And then the next time we see her, she is in the slave bikini, which for some reason has kind of, in our pop culture imagination over the past nearly 40 years, been turned into like a cute, sexy moment where she's wearing this hot bikini. And then, you know, eventually she kills Jabba while in her hot bikini. But it's really degrading. Like, yes, Carrie Fisher looks great, but that's not the point. The point is that they took the only main female character and for a good chunk of time put her in a really degrading outfit and put a literal collar around her neck. And in my opinion, having her kill Jabba doesn't counter that. Is that really an empowering moment if she had to be degraded to get there? And that was a conscious decision by the writers and directors to put her in that position. So even though it's played off as kind of a girl power moment, it really rings hollow to me. So that's just one example. Another good example is she is participating in the speeder chase on Endor, which is speeder chase holds up, even though you can tell it's like kind of CGI-ish, green screen. I still think it's really cool. But then, of course, she falls off her speeder and then turns into like this mother figure for this baby Ewok, which is just weird. Like, she becomes the bridge to the Ewoks other than 3PO, but for her it's very much a maternal role. And then when you see her in the Ewok camp, suddenly she's in this dress with her long flowing hair. And then my final kind of argument here is that she also gets stuck in this weird kind of love triangle, even though it's not a love triangle, between Luke and Han, where Han thinks she's into Luke. And it would be pretty easy for Leia to be like, no, I'm not into Luke. But that keeps going for like 45 minutes where she's in like this kind of weird triangle thing. It's just, you know, every time she does something cool, she gets hurt or gets thrown out of the picture, or is also wearing a gross bikini. And it's just frustrating that, yeah, she's doing more, but also the situations in which she are placed is still pretty sexist.
Yeah, the love triangle thing is something that stood out to me, because that's like one of the most annoying things to me about storytelling in general, is where there's a secret that one or more of the characters knows, and it would be fairly easy to tell the others. It's not like they are hiding it for some good reason or for the other person's own good, or because it's just too scary for them to admit, but they don't reveal it, and it creates more drama. And then later, once the writers have had the satisfaction of these dramatic, you know, scenes, then the character can unburden themselves and things get resolved. And it's like, sometimes there's a good reason why you can't say something in a particular moment, and that leads to misunderstandings that are regrettable but unavoidable. This was not that. I mean, I think back to that scene on the bridge of the Ewok, you know, village, and it's like, could you tell Luke? Is that how you could tell? And then she's like, oh, I just don't want to talk about it. And he's like, I'm sorry. And it's like, I don't understand the emotions that were happening there. Like, I know what I'm supposed to think was happening, which is that she is overwhelmed by this revelation. She's sad. She genuinely loves Luke, even if it's as a sibling. And she's sad that he's going away. He's probably going to die. And Han comes out and misinterprets the whole situation as romance. And she is just overwhelmed and can't clarify it. But it's like, Leia would not be overwhelmed by this to the point where she couldn't tell Han, like, no, you're misunderstanding, this is what it was. Like, if there's anything we know about Leia from the first two movies, it's that she is a steely person, and even when she's, you know, dealing with a lot of stress and a lot of trauma, such as, you know, her entire planet being destroyed, for example, she is even-keeled, and she's able to stay focused. And that's not to say that she's not allowed to break down. Like, I'm not saying that she can't cry or anything like that, just that, like, this was to me a very unrealistic portrayal of how she would manage the things that are going on in her life. Like, I don't believe that she would break down in that particular way at that particular moment. So that was just weird to me. You know, I don't know, I as far as the Ewok stuff, I saw that a little differently. My read on it was like, she's the only one of the three who would actually not only be able to handle meeting this strange species in a mature way, as we saw Han is not very good at that, but also, you know, unlike Luke, she has that kind of diplomatic skill set where she's able to engage with a previously unknown culture and form bonds to the point where she's able to convince them, you know, I guess with C-3PO's help, not to eat, you know, Luke and Han. And so I didn't necessarily read that as she's being a mother to this, you know, to this Ewok. I mean, Wicket is not a baby. We see babies in that scene. He's not one of them. So I don't know that, you know, clearly he's cute. He's cuddly. We're supposed to think of him as a teddy bear. I don't know that is he needs a mother figure. I think it's just he needs a reassuring presence who can sort of take charge of a situation and who can, you know, create a bond with this newly discovered species. So I don't know. I would suggest to me there's an alternative reading of that dynamic that is not so much the stereotypical, you know, women have to be mothers type of storytelling prison.
I agree with you in the first point that you were making on the bridge scene. The bridge scene makes no sense. I hate it. It's pointless. I don't like it at all. My counter to you on the Ewok stuff is that, first of all, she's not the one that convinces the Ewoks not to eat Luke and Han. In that moment, she's actually kind of useless, where she's like, but these are my friends, and they hold her back. And actually, it's Luke and 3PO who are able to convince them not to eat Luke and Han, because Luke uses his force powers there.
Right.
So she's kind of passive in that moment. I would also, this is getting a bit more nuanced here, but I would also just point out, you know, which characters are allowed to be immature and which ones have to be mature. And yes, you have a point with Leia having that diplomatic experience, but I mean, Han gets to be a man child throughout the three movies, and you just really can't see a female character getting to act the way he acts, particularly in the early 1980s. And then finally, there's this scene where they're all around the campfire, and Han is snuggling Leia, and then Wicket comes up and snuggles them. It's played as a scene for laughs, because, you know, Han is uncomfortable with Ewoks, and it is pretty funny. But it just suggests to me a stronger attachment that Wicket has to Leia than more than just, like, friendly alien species. But I will acknowledge that that is more of a subtle dynamic that also maybe I'm just particularly sensitive to. I don't think it's like an overt dynamic, but maybe just one that can be interpreted in a certain way. So I'll give you that.
Well, you know, you mentioned Han, and I do think it's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about him, because, man, he gets nothing in this movie.
I mean, he is nothing.
I can understand why Harrison Ford left Star Wars with a bad taste in his mouth, because, or you know, after the original trilogy, because not only did he not have that heroic death, but he didn't really get any service as far as character development in this film.
Absolutely none. I mean, he basically in this movie just exists for comic relief, and he gets some incredibly iconic lines. Like, the humor of Han in this movie cannot be denied. I mean, one of my favorite interactions of all time is when Luke and Han are on the barge going to the Sarlacc pit, and Luke's like, I used to live here, you know. And Han goes, you're going to die here, you know. Convenient. I just love that line. And there are so many good lines like that. He's very funny. But he has absolutely nothing to do. The only thing that he kind of does is he's announced a general leading this ground team on Endor. But even when he's on Endor, he's like pretty useless. He can't even open a door properly, which also is played for laughs, and he can't fight the Imperials without an army of teddy bears. So yeah, I mean, he really has nothing to do, and compared to the emotional heft of the first two movies and having him go from being smuggler to reluctant hero, to man like who is willing to sacrifice himself in Empire, and then in Return of the Jedi to just be there for jokes and an awkward pseudo love triangle, like that's a real disappointment for his character.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could say that his biggest accomplishment in this movie is tricking the Imperials in the bunker into opening the door with that, with the AT-ST. That's sort of the most concrete success that he has in the movie. And it's a very specific, you know, discrete moment. It's not some kind of big development in his arc or anything like that. It's not some, you know, Joseph Campbellian, you know, hero type of progress. It is, I think you could say this is, you know, Han's lack of character development in this movie is probably the critique of the original trilogy that you'd probably get the most fans to agree on. I mean, you know, I know there are a lot of people who don't like the Ewoks and the, you know, the CGI stuff like that. And I know we'll talk a little bit about that, but I think this is probably the area where you'd find the least disagreement that this was not handled well, which is rare to find broad agreement on something that was bad about this movie trilogy because of how hallowed it is. But I think this is it. I mean, it's really Han not getting what you would expect him to get. I mean, you know, Leia gets more than he does in this movie. And we've already talked about how many things there are in this movie to question about how they portray Leia. You know, he does get some good lines, though. I mean, and he gets some funny scenes, like, you know, the scene with what I thought you were going to mention is him and 3PO, where 3PO is asking the Ewoks for help and Han keeps tapping him on the shoulder. I think that was really genuinely very funny. But that's pretty much the only role that he plays in this movie.
Yeah, he has a very unsatisfying role. And I think part of that is that the Han-esque role goes to Lando, in a sense, in that Lando gets control of the Millennium Falcon and is the one doing the trench run along with Wedge, my beloved, and killing the second Death Star. And I think, you know, I have absolutely no problem with that. We already know I'm a Lando fan. But that would have seemed to be the role that Han would have played. It's certainly the role that he played in A New Hope. But in Return of the Jedi, he's kind of saddled to Luke and Leia and their respective plot lines in a way that is detrimental to his own. And I think that there was definitely a way that they could have given him something to do and continue to develop his character beyond, you know, funny guy who's jealous of Luke for some reason. But they did not choose to do that. And so here we are with a very one-note Han whose characterization kind of undercuts that of the previous two films.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, the critique of The Last Jedi is we want to see the trio together, and they decided not to keep them together, but that meant they had to give, you know, Finn something else to do, and that created the Canto Bight, you know, storyline, which is not universally well received. Whereas in this movie, the problem was that they wanted to keep the trio together, and yet they couldn't figure out what to give Han in that moment. And it's almost like I would rather have them separate the trio, who we've seen together much more than we saw the sequel trilogy trio together up to this point in the final movie. And you know, so separate Han out from that, because we've seen him with Luke and Leia quite a bit, and put him in the Falcon. You know, I don't necessarily know that Han's background as a smuggler was this, you know, make him far and away the best choice to lead the strike team on the ground. Put some secondary character in there. Doesn't have to be somebody that we know. That's not a role where that person needs to be at the forefront of all the scenes. And again, as we've talked about, what does Han do on Endor that prevents you from replacing him with someone else?
Yeah, nothing. He does nothing. And yeah, I mean, it totally could have been Han and Lando in the Falcon doing the trench run. There was no real reason for Han to be on Endor besides what little they gave him. So yeah, I think we can agree in this case, generally speaking, Luke's arc is good, Leia's arc is problematic, and Han's arc just, I mean, it doesn't exist. Yeah. Does that seem like a fair assessment?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on to some miscellaneous fun talking points. Ewoks, funny or annoying? Discuss.
I gotta say funny. I mean, I think, you know, one of my favorite things about Star Wars, one of the big themes that I really like, is this idea that nature and living beings that are in tune with the living force can triumph over, you know, cold, detached, mechanized autonomy. You know, that there's just something intangible that when you are in touch with nature that gives you the strength to find these creative ways to defeat, you know, people who have chosen to separate themselves from all of that. I just really like that theme. I really like it in Star Wars, and the Clone Wars did this a lot, where animals would help the good guys, you know, defeat the bad guys. I just think that that's such an interesting and fun thing to see in Star Wars. I just really like that. And so I think the Ewoks, while they are sentient, they're not quite the same as a lot of the animals that we see in Star Wars doing this. You know, there's a thematic connection there in that they're underestimated. They present themselves as this cute, disarmingly a teddy bear-esque creature, and yet they're smart, they're resourceful, they're, you know, they know what they're doing, even if there are moments that are played as comic relief in the story. I mean, there are certainly moments, you know, Wicket is swinging around the throwing stone and he accidentally hits himself in the face with it, but that's like a Wicket moment. That's not like an Ewok thing. They actually get their due. I mean, they perform very well in the Battle of Endor, and they are invaluable to stopping the Empire, and it's because they are, first of all, they're brave, but second of all, they know the terrain, and they know what they can do with, you know, log traps and all that stuff. And, you know, we can question whether hitting a stormtrooper with a stone, you know, would be enough to take him down, but certainly I think a lot of the ways that they fight back are genuinely reasonable, you know, combat tactics that make sense, and I think that they are a great part of the movie. And there's a scene where, you know, one of the Ewoks is killed and the other one starts to, you know, mourn his body. And I almost can't even mention that scene because it is genuinely emotional for a lot of people to watch that scene. And I think that shows you that they're not just comic relief. They look cute, but they're real people who are playing a real role in this battle.
I was going to mention the Ewok death scene and the emotional resonance. But we are at a rare juncture where I completely agree with you. I have no notes. I think that assessment of the Ewoks is correct. And I think that ultimately they're a good addition to the movie, and they're funny and they're cute, but still have that emotional aspect. And also, I mean, you even put it in a way that I hadn't thought of before, which is that Star Wars theme of the connection with the Force running deeper than the mechanized might of the Empire. I think that's a really good point. So yeah, I agree with you. We are Team Ewok here on Hoth Takes, which is a pretty Hoth take, I would say, among Star Wars fans. And that brings me to a corollary, however, to the Ewok discussion, which is 3PO in this movie drives me insane. I find him so grating. And for some reason, you know, his whole thing as King of the Ewoks, I just think is very annoying. So am I incorrect in that take?
I mean, I would just like to hear more about why you feel that way. I don't know that I have strong feelings. The King stuff doesn't bother me. I guess the only argument you can make against it is in the vein of what I was just talking about with the Ewoks. It does treat them as simpletons and primitives, and they certainly don't use technology the way that humans do throughout most of Star Wars, but that doesn't make them cognitively primitive. And yet I think the King stuff does treat them, that there's an element of sort of, you know, European explorers and their technology being, you know, believed to be magic or things like that by, you know, by the native people that they come in contact with. And an undercurrent of that, at least as that's portrayed in popular culture, is, you know, these stupid people don't understand our modern technology, and we can dominate them because they will defer to us as gods, and they're just savages. And I think that there's an undercurrent of that in the King stuff. I don't necessarily know that that is the goal of that scene. I wouldn't say that was what George Lucas had in mind. Certainly you can make the argument that it brings that up, But I'd be curious to hear why you see, 3PO in that light.
I think that is a big part of it. I mean, we already know, and it has been said by smarter people than I, that there is a real undercurrent of colonialism to Star Wars in general. And you can see it in a lot of the movies and in this movie as well, where there's this indigenous species that, ends up bravely fighting for the right side. But in this sense, the movie does kind of look down upon them and treat them as a joke and as unrefined or primitive. And I think that is part of why the 3PO plotline with him being a god really bothers me, because it brings that undercurrent to the forefront. And I don't think that was George Lucas's intention, but that just shows our own storytelling biases as Americans, and particularly an American white guy in the 70s and 80s. Like, those biases are just unconscious and part of the narrative, and it's not intentional, but it is there, and it is something that I think we should call out when it appears. So that is part of it.
So you're saying we should teach critical space theory. I'm sorry, it was sitting right there. Go ahead.
That's a good one. That's actually genuinely good. That was not a pity laugh, Eric. I found that funny.
First real laugh that I got from Grace in this entire show.
Yeah, that's very funny. Critical space theory. I'm going to steal that. But other than that actual critique, for me, 3PO is always on the border of funny and annoying. And in this one, he doesn't have R2 as much to kind of play off of him. And when they play off each other, they're a great iconic duo. As I said in our New Hope episode, I believe, happy pride to 3PO and R2. But when 3PO's on his own without R2 to counter him and without them to play off each other, he just annoys me. So there's no real deep thought there, other than I just find him personally annoying for much of it.
Another reason why R2-D2 is so important.
Indeed. I actually hadn't thought of it in that way until I was watching this movie, that without R2, that dynamic really, and that character really doesn't do it for me. So, yet another reason to love R2-D2.
Absolutely.
Another thing that I can briefly discuss, that is very controversial among fans, is the added CGI stuff that George Lucas did later. And I will confess, I've never seen the original pre-edition movies.
Oh my God.
I know. In my defense, the library only had the new edition of the movies, and I rented all my DVDs from the library. So, and now, of course, the only editions available on streaming are the original, or are the revised ones. But the point is, in my entire Star Wars watching experience, I have only ever had the CGI scene in Jabba's palace of the singers doing that song for some reason. And this is my first time watching this movie since I saw Clone Wars, the TV show, and it occurred to me, is that Zero the Hutt's girlfriend doing the song in Jabba's palace? Because if so, that's just a really fun little connection, and go her for continuing to sing after murdering someone in cold blood.
Yeah, that's Sai Snoodles, by the way, looking pretty good for, however old she is at that point.
Yeah, And I think, well, first of all, as an aside, I have to mention that when I first saw Return of the Jedi when I was like 10 or whatever, I hadn't realized that there had been changes. So I was so impressed by the fact that there was an actor who looked just like Hayden Christensen in the final scene with all the Force ghosts. So I was like, wow, that's so impressive that in 1983 they had this actor play Anakin as a Force ghost, and then 20 years later they hired Hayden Christensen to play Anakin. Like, what a crazy coincidence that they looked so similar. Well done casting.
Yeah.
But no, it's actually Hayden Christensen, and that was added later. For the people who don't know.
I would love to like have a conversation with someone who thought that and be like, yeah, so I mean, they were really just looking for somebody who could match the performance from Return of the Jedi. Like, Hayden Christensen came along and they were like, wow, it is eerie how much you look like, you know, Bob Smith, you know, from Return of the Jedi. I mean, just we gotta hire you.
That was literally how I thought it went down. It was a couple years before I realized, I will admit. In my defense, I was young. And I guess my final discussion point that I have for Return of the Jedi is that there are some really fun aliens. Like, I love Jabba's palace and all the cool aliens we get to see, even the CGI singer aliens. I mean, obviously, I had the complaint of yet more sexism with the treatment of sexy Twi'lek women wearing their slave bikinis. But other than that, I mean, there are just so many cool aliens in Jabba's palace, and especially my favorite, Salacious B. Crumb. Rest in power, King. I don't think he dies, but I still love him.
I think he gets a rest in power. Just, I mean, he's just a champ. I will say that this is definitely the movie where you really feel like this is a Star Wars universe, which is a strange thing to say, because one of the strengths of A New Hope was that it made you feel like you were dropping into a place that already existed. But that was sort of, it gave you the feeling that the place already existed and that it was deep and diverse. This is, I think, the first movie where you really actually see that diversity. You actually see all these places that aren't part of the Star Wars, the Skywalker story. Like, pretty much everything in the previous two, with the exception of, you know, Bespin, to which you don't actually see very much of, is like, this is like Skywalker saga, good versus evil, like locations and characters. This is where you really actually start to see firsthand the wild diversity of settings and people outside of that dynamic. And obviously, just as a storytelling point, that's great. It makes the place feel bigger and more interesting. It takes the sort of the exoticism of the cantina, just in terms of a place that you've never seen before in cinema, and it magnifies it to 100. But also just visually, if you're just talking about from a movie-making standpoint, it's gorgeous. Just the colors are amazing, especially after the relatively bland color palette of Empire Strikes Back, which was, you know, bleak on Hoth and then, you know, two-tone on Cloud City. This is just a riot of colors, and just from that perspective alone, I mean, I think there's just a vibrancy to it that the previous two movies don't have.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with your assessment on making it feel like a wider world for the first time and really getting to see and feel that alien diversity and the diversity of locations, and I really appreciate it. I think it's just such a fun thing. I'm sure the blue elephant puppet guy in...
Max Rebo. Love him. Yeah, what
Max
a king.
Max Rebo. I was just about to say, I'm sure he has a name, and he did, and you knew it, which of course you did.
Ask, tell me any character, and I can name him. This would be a fun game. No, let's not do that right now.
Yeah, not right now, it'll take too long. But Max Rebo, like, every time I see him, he brings me joy. So shout out to you, Max Rebo, and Salacious B. Crumb in particular. Great, great puppets. They will live on in our hearts forever.
Yeah, gotta give a shout out to the excellent musical performances in Jabba's Palace. Obviously, a lot of, you know, platinum record-selling artists there. It was the Star Wars version of Woodstock, I think you could say. Certainly, they were probably doing just as many drugs in Jabba's Palace.
Yeah, like Bonnaroo for aliens.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest topics for future shows, you can always email us at hothtakes@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at hothtakes. I'm at @Grace_Seegers on Twitter. Eric is at Eric Geller. And Haley, who is still out on maternity leave and we miss her very much, is at Burdenator. Haley made our incredible logo and banner art, and Eric edited the show and put together our music. Although, as always, for legal purposes, we should note that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com. If you like the show, share it with a friend. Just tell them to subscribe on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.